I want to welcome everyone to another episode of Keeping It Real with Frankie D, the very first Italian-American podcast and the home of the Italian-American moment. I'm your very proud host, Frankie D, and we can be heard at ItalianAmericanLife.com. And please like us and follow us on all the social media outlets. My guests today are Matt Walker and Zen Bowers, who are Grammy-nominated classical musicians and recording artists, played with the Nashville Symphony for 20 years. They are in the travel consulting business. They have published 4 award-winning guidebooks based on Northern Italy and Ireland. And in the last few years, they have written another book, which is called I Can't Believe We Live Here. And what they're talking about is packing up everything, selling everything in America and moving to Italy. So I cannot wait to hear about that as well. Matt and Zen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you both.
Thanks so much for having us, Frank.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
That was an exhausting introduction. You've done so much with your lives to this point. It's incredible. And I was thinking about where do we go with this, because there's just so much. But I mean, basically, let's start with your classical musicians. But how did you get into this guidebooks and travel guide business? How did you start with that?
Started traveling to Italy on our honeymoon in 2006. We got married in 2005. We started traveling here in 2006. And to make a long story slightly less long, between Rome and Venice and Milan, driving all around Italy, we started to get to really have a love for the smaller towns and the places where all the tourists weren't. And so we started coming back again and again and exploring these sort of more out of the way areas of Italy, and developed this base of knowledge in small towns and the foods of different regions.
And we found that we could do it much more often because everything was so cheap in small towns, food and lodging, but it was really, really nice. You could be staying in a medieval tower for $100. So we could be having these really incredible, unique experiences, and it wasn't killing us in the pocketbook, but that's because we weren't going to big cities or resorts.
And this is all while we were working full time as musicians in Nashville with the symphony and also the recording industry and also running our own chamber ensemble as well. So it was a lot of stuff going on, but we juggled our calendars.
But these trips were really just for fun. And then after, I don't know, maybe like 2 or 3 years of traveling, because we would go 4 to 6 times a year for a week at a time. And maybe it was like 2 or 3 years. And we started to find, this was me, because people would write to me and say, hey, I see how you're traveling. I'm following it on Facebook or whatever. Can you help me plan a trip? Can you tell me where this is going? And I would have put 12 to 15 hours a week into helping other people plan vacations. And then we were over at a friend's house one night for dinner, a couple of our friends who are much smarter business people than we are.
It was almost everybody, actually.
Yeah. And they said, hey, dummies, that's a business. You know, like what you're doing is a service and you should turn it into a business. And it hadn't occurred to us. I just thought this is a lot of work.
And so we did that simultaneously with working with the symphony. We started this little business on the side, and it got a little bit of traction. And so we were doing the two things, the music and this other thing. And by far the music was still the overwhelming majority of
bread and butter.
In those first few years, we hardly had any clients at all, because really our service, it remains the same as it was when we started it, which is a really niche business just for people who are looking for small town places. And we only send people to places that we've been to ourselves, and we don't take any kickbacks or discounts from the places. So when we go and explore, we're paying full price, full rate. We don't tell the businesses who we are, because they're, first of all, they wouldn't know or care. And second of all, we're not there to get a discount. So, or they're not going to get any kickbacks when we send people there, et cetera. So You know, it didn't really, for a long, long time, our business made zero financial sense because you have to plow just an insane amount of money into it. And then you would hardly have any clients. But of course, we were doing the trips anyway for fun. And so it just kind of made sense. And now it has blossomed into this thing. And I guess maybe I would say out of maybe every 10 people that contact us, probably one becomes a client. Because most people are still looking for either large groups, you know, hey, my family, all my entire family, 10 people are coming in a group. We can't do that. It's got to be enough people that fit into a Fiat Cinquecento, the end. So, you know,
very small amount of people.
Really small, right, going to small towns, wanting to just travel the way we do because we're trying to share the experience that we have. We don't have the experience with renting a whole villa or renting a bus or a driver or anything like that. It's just self-guided tours in these small towns. And we're trying to make it easier for people to travel, like the kind of thing we would have wanted when we started, you know?
So initially you're doing actual guiding, and then did you get into books after?
No, well, I guess it sort of happened, the beginning of our business sort of happened simultaneously with publishing our first guidebook. To be clear, we don't do any actual guiding per se. We're definitely not guides, and we never want to go anywhere with our clients. No offense to our clients. But we just lay out their itineraries for them and then send them off on their way.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
And we make all the reservations for them, their meals, and then we tell them where to go, and we hook them up with like certain artists or different experiences that we've found that are
different kinds of food tours or something like that.
Because everybody wants to do food tours, but those so many, like if you were going to go to see a Parmigiano Reggiano cheese tour, well, there's about 11 million. But do you want to see one that is maybe not with 400 other tourists just got off a bus? That's what we're looking for. And finding it for just a couple of people in English on a real farm that is a working farm, those are far and few between. Well, or is it few and far between? Whatever it is.
I wasn't about to correct you on that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so that is what we do with that business. Now, I should say, just to be clear, although we do an awful lot with this travel stuff and we love doing it, and it's what inspired us to love Italy so much that we dropped everything in the U.S., sold everything and came here permanently. The way we were able to come here permanently was we got work visas as musicians. So we are here on work permits as they call it lavoro autonomo, which is self-employment. And we're here as musicians. We're doing this other stuff on the side. Musicians is still our sort of primary
form of concert organizing and cultural experiences. And in our trips, part of it is working that into part of their trip, not necessarily concerts, but cultural experiences. So,
right. And I read in the book that's how mm-hmm. you got the visa. Is that, mm-hmm. you know, one thing I was curious about, does the visa, a work visa like that, does that expire after so many years and you have to reapply?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. The visa itself and the terminology gets a little bit confusing, at least the way our immigration lawyer has explained it to us. The visa itself, when you apply for that and receive it, is a permit to enter the country as whatever it is you've
under
the visa
these
for,
circumstances.
Under the circumstances of being a worker, in our case, a self-employed worker, then you have to get a permit to stay, the permesso di soggiorno. A lot of people get this permesso, this permit as retirees who can show they have enough passive
or
income,
family members
or familial connections, blood connections.
But then it's the permesso di soggiorno that you have to renew again and again. And for
in our
that,
case, it's every couple of years.
You have to meet their benchmarks each time. So you don't have to reapply for the visa, but they've set out what, like, for example, for us as workers, we have to make a certain amount of money, each of us, each year.
And show that we're paying the taxes on that income.
Yes. And then we have to, and then of all these other documents, we have to do things like not commit any crimes. And
that's really the big
one. That really is the big one. Yeah.
And make the money and pay the taxes.
Yeah. And I think otherwise, and then, if you're not, then there's just some paperwork, little mini bits, you know, of paperwork that you've got to keep current. But I mean, it was it's hard to describe. There's not really a good analogy for it, but it's just that the visa is the thing that opens the door, and then you have to keep
the
renewing
permit to stay needs to get renewed. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So, from the book, I loved, I really, really loved it. I want to read the whole title. I Can't Believe We Live Here. The wild but true story of how we dropped everything in the States and moved to Italy right before the end of the world. So it was an incredible journey that you guys took. This was not just, you know, calling a travel agent and getting a ticket and leaving. You jumped through hoops just to be able to get the permission, the everything. It was just incredible. And I really enjoyed the book. Tell me that moment where the two of you looked at each other and said, now you both have no Italian lineage of blood in you. Is that correct?
That's true.
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Very unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah, we were.
But you both looked at each other in one moment and said, because lots of people go like, oh my God, it'd be beautiful to live here. I'd love to live here. But when you really seriously look at your better half and you say, let's do this. Tell me about that moment.
Well, a lot of research had gone into it before that moment happened, because it's hard to say. Well, the classical music industry is pretty small, and it's very difficult to get a job there. And certainly
in the United States.
Yeah, but yeah. Definitely, yeah. In the United States. So, for example, when my job opened up, or a job, like just a job opens up, you would have 300-400 applicants for that single position. And then they would call it down to like maybe 100 people that would be invited to the audition. And then maybe it'd be like 150 people invited. And then maybe 75-100 people would show up at the audition day. And each of those 75-100 people would get 5 minutes to play on stage behind a screen. So no one knows what gender or race that you are, or who you are, in case it's somebody that you know. You walk out on a carpet so they can't hear if you're wearing heels or not. You're not allowed to speak so that you can't be identified. And everybody plays the same 5 minutes of music. And then they call that down from that first round to, I don't know, however many, they end up with 20 to go to the second round, the semifinals, and then finals. So getting those jobs is an event. And most people go through dozens of auditions until they get a single job. And that's why you don't let go of that job. Like, they can get it from you by plying it from your cold, dead hands. And
they actually have carpet, so they can't.
Oh yeah. Well, there's a proctor behind the screen with you. The committee is out in the hall, in not visible to you, to them. And you are not permitted to speak to them. So you can speak to the proctor, but you have to whisper. And then you could say, I didn't understand the instruction, or I just vomited on myself, or whatever you have to say to the proctor. And the proctor would speak for you because they don't want to, you shouldn't be identified for all of the reasons of bias.
Keep it fair. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the way they do it in Chicago, like, because we don't do a lot of things fair here, but I mean, yeah. I'm assuming they probably do it that way. How many people are at like the Chicago Symphony, the Nashville Symphony? How many people are on the symphony?
Probably somewhere between 80 and 100, depending on the orchestra.
Yeah.
Altogether, the entire group of musicians.
Yeah. And then those jobs just don't come up very often. And so it's
and
not
for
it's
each
not
individual
a small
instrument,
thing.
Much fewer.
It's not a small thing to get rid of. And it's not a thing where we could say, for example, as a couple, oh, well, let's just move to San Francisco and just get jobs there or whatever, because that's just ridiculous. Why don't I just become a ballerina now? I'm 50. I mean, get out of here.
Okay.
That's just ridiculous. So,
all this is to say that the competitive nature of this field of classical music in the orchestra business is such that we knew that if we gave up our jobs to try to do this thing, that would be it for us. Almost
you're probably
surely
never playing an orchestra again. Probably mm-hmm. not.
I get it.
And if you are, it's probably amateur, and you're just probably not. So you'd have to give up this great love, which is hard to do. And so we did a lot of research before to see if this was even possible, because as we were traveling over here, we would look at lovingly in the real estate windows at the all the pictures of their homes, and some of them were just crazy, you know, $3 million, and it was like, we'll get out of here. But some of them were really, really affordable, and we were surprised. And so then we looked into it, because every country in the world has rules about who can live there and for what length of time. And so we started looking into it, and it seemed like impossible. It just seemed, when you read the rules, you thought, oh, we are never going to meet these benchmarks. So
maybe then, when we're 80, but by then we'll be already dead for like 10 years.
I
mean,
yeah. Right. So no, I get it.
We found this apartment, which we really liked, and we already had we never carried any debt except for a mortgage in the United States. So but we had a home equity loan because we thought we were going to have to get a new roof
for some repairs that we were doing. So we had a chunk of money sitting there in the bank. And
it turned out we didn't need a new roof. And so we had this loan sitting there, and then we found this apartment for 26,000 euro. And we thought, you know, we go there so often, maybe we should
just
buy
this
little
apartment. It'd be fun to have this as a little base for now and then.
And we would get it, and we could let our friends use it, and we could pay it off in not too long of a period of time. After we bought the apartment, I said to Matt, well, like, let's talk to an immigration lawyer, because we have this fantasy of moving there, but everything I'd read made it sound like it was just very unlikely. And
for people in our economic bracket, even though we had full-time salaried jobs with some nominal benefits, it wasn't gonna cut.
Yeah. And so then we, you know, with no debt and nobody cares. Mm-hmm. So we said, well, let's just go pay this guy for an hour to have him tell us, give it up, you know.
Was that the lawyer in Florence?
Yeah.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So we talked to him, and the way we describe it in the book was we expected him to say this is stupid, you guys. There's no chance. There's no way you can do this. That'll be 250 euro, please.
Yeah, right. I remember that part in the book.
Yeah, but instead he said, yeah, you know, you guys, your credentials as musicians and your background and all the people you've worked with and your connections and all this stuff. The word Grammy in your bio, it doesn't hurt, you know.
Wow.
All this meant that you should apply for this thing, and you should do it right now, because as it turned out, this lawyer happened to know, because that's his gig to know, that the quotas had come out for what kind of work they were going to be giving visas for in the coming year, musician and organizer of cultural events was one of those. And so we applied for, in fact, two of those.
Well, obviously, because he thought that both of us in our careers, which are paralleled in many ways, but also diverse in different ways. And he thought that each of us would personally qualify for our own. And we did. And so they get, it's kind of like finding two Willy Wonka bars. You're like, no way.
Yeah.
So, right. I never read the book, but I'm told.
The golden ticket or whatever.
Yeah.
Golden ticket. So there's only one.
So we got two of those. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. What did you feel like all the stars were aligning and everything was going?
This was just when we decided to try to do it.
Trying.
But trying to do it means deciding to do it, because if we were successful in getting the visa, which we didn't know at the time, it wouldn't for months. But if we were successful, we had to act immediately
right.
to move, sell everything.
You have to use the visa within 3 months or lose it forever. And you can only apply one time. So you gotta know you're ready to do it. Before.
If you're going to do this, you had to do it 150%.
And we did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was just hard because the time we got it till the time we left was like 6 weeks or something crazy.
Okay. So you buy an apartment just to buy the apartment for, like what you said, the apartment, 50 square meters, correct?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's about 500 square feet. It means we need to very carefully manage each other's bathroom use, because there's only one.
Yeah. It means you better like the person you're in there with, especially if you're locked up in with them for 10 flipping weeks in a pandemic.
Yes. Well,
that's the other
500 square feet with two people. That's, yeah. No, I get it.
And we have four cats.
At the time we moved with four cats.
Right? Four cats and 500 square feet sounds like the worst odd couple episode ever.
Yeah, a little bit, yes. Oh. It's okay to mention the town you live in, correct?
Of course, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you live in Soriano nel Cimino. Now, It's an hour north of Rome. You're in Lazio, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
How big of a town is this? How many people
live? It's about 8,000 or 9,000 people in the whole, including the sort of surrounding suburbs.
Okay.
But 8,000 or 9,000 altogether.
Okay. No, so it's three, not, this is not un paese piccolino. It's.
No. It's big enough where, like, now after 4 years, we have several people that recognize us, honk when they see us on the street or wave, but the overwhelming majority of people have no idea who we are, or they might recognize our face and be like, what the hell is the deal with those people? You know?
So if it was a small town, everybody would know who you were.
That's right.
This kind of a village. What we were looking for was this sort of sweet spot of the size of a village, because it's not like you're talking about where everybody knows what color underwear I wore yesterday. Or that kind of thing.
Trust me,
it's not,
I know.
So big, yes. It's not so big that it's a huge bustle and cluster of.
Yes. No, I think that's a very, I'm familiar. My family are from small towns. My wife was born in a small town in a mountain in Calabria. It's like una frazione.
It's
so small. And when I tell you, they know what you ate for dinner. They know when you fought with your spouse. They know everything, but yet where you guys are, it's not like that. There's services, there's businesses, there's a little smallish,
definitely.
And but yet I like
they
that.
Know, I mean, I think they know stuff, definitely know stuff about us, but I'm not ready for the type of closeness that is, you know what I ate for dinner. I'm just not ready for that.
It comes with a town of 100 or 200 people.
That's the kind of towns I'm talking about. Yeah. 300-400 people.
We love to visit those towns. For
absolutely.
Sure.
And
we visited countless of those. After traveling here for a week at a time or 2 weeks at a time to Italy, all over the map, mostly, as I said, between in the northern part from Rome to the north up to the lakes. After probably close to 50 visits here, we got a very good idea of what we liked and didn't like, what we would want and what we needed and what we didn't need and all that sort of stuff. So we got a great idea of that. This town, for example, has three different pharmacies. And I mentioned this in particular because, and this was a factor to have at least more than one. Three is a good number for that, because if either of us have some kind of extremely embarrassing condition, we can go to one of the ones across town, meaning like 10 minutes walk away instead of only 4 minutes walk away.
Yeah. You know, and then just not go back for like 9 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Options are nice. Right.
Well, don't say 9 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm 50. It doesn't anymore. No,
you get the idea.
I really do. I was in Italy about 4 months ago, and I was in Abruzzo, where my father's family's from. And the actual town is a very small town, but we stayed. I don't know if you ever heard of Sulmona.
Yes. The almonds. Sulmona
is the confetti.
Yeah.
The sugar-coated almonds. That's what they're known for. Yeah. And Sulmona is like 20,000 people, so maybe double the town you're living in, as opposed to the small town that has like 1,000 people. And I could see where, you know, I'm from Chicago. I'm born, raised, live in Chicago. How could I go from Chicago to a little town living, you know, 800 people? It would be difficult. But like a Sulmona or like your town, I could see that. It's got the small town appeal, but yet it's big enough. So no, that sounds wonderful. And I believe
it's definitely a sweet spot there. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're near Viterbo. Which
we are.
Viterbo is the big city here. It's the sort of, I guess you would say, county seat or something equivalent, more or less. And it's about 80,000 people.
Is that the province that you live in?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's the center of the province of Viterbo.
Got you.
Yeah.
Okay, and I believe you're not that far from Abruzzo, really.
No, actually,
we can see the tips of some of the Abruzzo mountains.
Oh, you can.
Yeah.
We can also see into Umbria, and just because of the angle of the where the castle is, we can't see Tuscany. But if our castle wasn't in the way, we could see Tuscany from here in theory.
Well, you know what,
very,
you guys...
We're very close to the borders of all those, yeah.
Oh, my God. You guys did what people think about, dream about, but they just can't hold us the trigger. You know what I mean? It's you know, what you're describing, we could see Abruzzo, we could see Umbria, we could see... That's amazing. That's just, this is from your balcony that you could see all these things?
Yeah, we have this little, for the listeners at home, we have this little balcony out on the back, which is one of the selling points because it's got a view of our town's castle. And then off to the right, you can look into the Tiber Valley and across to Umbria and a little bit of Abruzzo there with the mountains in the far distance that get snow capped in the winter. It's really fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
And we were extremely grateful for this feature of this apartment 3 months after we moved here, when the lockdowns started here in Italy, the pandemic broke out in Europe. Italy was the first place that all started.
But there were a lot of government decrees and they were really quite strict. And of course, as immigrants here, we cannot screw around with making any kind of gray lines about rules or whatever. I mean, we only recently started double parking for like 2 minutes at a time, you know, and
which is the norm here. If you're going to go
standard there, right, but right. I get it. What you're saying,
you know, you're going to see me in every crosswalk because I am not screwing around. Yeah. I'll never remember when we were down waiting in line at the post office down here. I forget. We were just waiting to mail something.
It was after the initial very strict lockdowns had lifted, but there were still severe restrictions. Everybody was masked, and we were at the post office to renew our permit to stay, our permesso di soggiorno, and we were online outside with a handful of other people that we were chatting with people at a safe distance. Everybody's
you had to be 6 feet apart. Well, yeah, six,
2 meters.
Three,
and a car with a carabinieri, the state police, came around and. They basically screeched on their brakes and got
you
out.
You heard them brake.
They
it
got
was
out
terrible.
And they walked over straight to us because in a small town, the Carabinieri do know everybody. And we didn't look familiar to them. And so they were saying,
papers, please. And we had to produce them
papers,
right
please.
Now.
And luckily we did have everything in order. And
yeah, pull this to the side. Get out your papers. Proof. What are you doing here? Why are you here? Who are you? What is this?
Yeah.
And I mean, and I'll tell you what, I sweat through my shirt. And even though it was all in order, this is about crap.
And we knew we had everything in order, and we knew we were doing everything right with the masking and the distancing and all that stuff. We knew we were allowed to be there, etc. Even so, that was very nerve wracking for new immigrants.
At the end of the day, you're in a foreign country, and I mean, you don't know what they may come up with. You're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and we are all in here. And...
Yeah, we don't have, unlike almost every other American who lives here or has a place here that we've met anyway, we do not have a place to live in the States. You know, we have family, obviously, but we don't have a house or an apartment or whatever in the States in case something happens to our situation here and we have to go back to the
right.
Yeah, like kicking us out of the country is a mortal wound here. It's not just like a minor inconvenience. It is
going in all like 100%.
It's a nuclear.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So the balcony.
So we want to make sure everything's sorted.
Oh, absolutely. The balcony. Can you fit a table out there on the balcony to eat and
We have a couple of cushy sort of patio chairs out there and a little coffee
table. We have a table out there. We have a gas grill out there and a little olive tree.
Yeah, a little olive tree,
a little bigger than I thought. And I know from the book.
No, it's a very small olive tree.
tree, but I mean, it's a serviceable balcony. It's what Italy is made of. Italy is balconies. And you know, the view is priceless. So during
you could park two cars on it.
You could walk
two.
I think, I mean, you couldn't get the car. I think
two
you
very
could,
small cars.
You could park two Fiat.
So it's a pretty big balcony.
Give you an estimation. Yeah.
Well,
okay. Well, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. Not a Hummer. Yeah.
That's awesome. So during the pandemic, I believe you guys started playing some music. Was it a nightly thing?
Yeah. Yeah. We decided we had to do something, a project of some sort to just keep ourselves sane. And obviously the obvious thing to do was, as a lot of other people were doing around the country and later in the States as well, and pretty much everywhere. What we started was a nightly concert at 6 o'clock p.m. We played a different piece every night. It was only 5 or 10 minutes, depending on the length of the piece that we
chose. Yeah, it was six o'clock every night. And that's how they started. If you remember at the very beginning, they did like a night where everybody came out and maybe sang to each other or called to each other.
The town declared a specific day. Hey, said, hey, this evening at 6 o'clock, everybody get out on your balconies or stick your head out your window and wave to each other and say hi.
For community.
Greet each other, just for a community, you know.
Sure, to bring spirits up and have a little human.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that was at 6 o'clock. And then we thought, you know what, we should do this playing thing. And so we did. And we did that first, I think, just ourselves playing for a handful of neighbors that might have been out at that same time. It coincides more or less with typical aperitivo time, so that was mm-hmm. convenient for everybody.
Also, no one was legally allowed to leave their house, so that helps.
So where else are they going to go? Talk about a captive audience.
And a built-in audience. Yeah. But they enjoyed it, the people?
A handful of people that could, that were within eyeshot or earshot of our balcony enjoyed that. And then we started transmitting it on Facebook, a Facebook Live thing. And then shortly after that, our town got wind of it, like a couple of days in, really. Our town got wind of it and said, hey, we're gonna broadcast you guys the audio into the town square at 6 o'clock. But can you do us a favor and start at 10 after six instead of 6 o'clock, because we're going to broadcast the national anthem.
Did they do that every night? Honey.
Yeah, mm-hmm. every night on the PA, you know. And so they broadcast that every night, and we could hear it across the way because it came out into the town square, and then we could hear it echoing, and then we would start our broadcast more or less right after that, and we would say Buonasera Soriano, and then we would introduce our piece in English and in Italian, and then we would play it, and then we'd say Buonasera e buona salute a tutti, good health everyone.
Wow.
And then we'd sign off. And what was kind of funny was that after we finished playing, we could hear there was a little bit of a delay from our Facebook transmission to getting out into the town square. And so we could hear the last few notes of our thing coming across the little valley here from the castle area to us. And so that was kind of fun.
Well, that's great.
So we did that a different piece every night for 62 nights in a row.
Wow.
That was bonkers, though, because this ensemble of violin and cello doesn't have very much music written for it. It's usually two violins, viola, cello. But this violin and cello doesn't have very many pieces written for it. And a lot of the stuff that's written for it is crap. It's kind of ringtone-y, just real thin and lame or boring. So when we moved over here, we were anticipating, obviously, since we're here as musicians, that we would be playing together. And we had amassed a lot of music that we thought was quality music that was good for us to present in concert, of different types,
modern music and also old Baroque music from
but a
the
lot
17th
of that
century.
Did not work for this broadcast because it would be either too long, maybe impossible to play when it's 40 degrees outside in the driving flipping rain, or maybe it just wouldn't carry well over you know, the crappy sound system we have, which is basically two styrofoam cups and a dental floss. I mean, it was like, you had to consider all that stuff because it's not really a service or a gift if what you're offering is like a boiled hot dog or whatever. It's like, just forget it. A lot of the stuff we had to get rid of, and a lot of our friends that are musicians and composers helped us by either making arrangements for us, sending us suggestions or ideas. And then we would pretty much spend, I would say, if we woke up in the morning at like 8, maybe 8 to 11 a.m. would just be general angst about the state of the world and if we were going to die in this apartment. And then maybe 11 to 4 would be working on the program.
Like what the hell are we going to play tonight?
Yeah.
And, or I'm making an arrangement of some tune or whatever. And then,
And then 4 to 6 would be general panic about, oh my God, we're going live on Facebook again in the freezing cold and with tons of mistakes and you can't edit it. Or, you know, we didn't get a Grammy nomination with an unedited CD. Okay. So it wasn't awesome.
There's a lot to it that someone like me wouldn't understand. Yeah. And probably the majority of people. So,
yeah, 6:20 to bedtime would be griping about the mistakes that you just made on live broadcast.
A lot of preparation.
Now do it again at 8 a.m. Yeah.
I get it.
So we did the lockdown started in the second week of March, and so that speaks to the temperatures. And by and large, the weather more or less cooperated. Sometimes it was colder or windier than we would have liked. And we did about 5 or 6 of those inside just because it was too much driving rain or below 40 degrees.
Well, or the wind was so strong that you cannot hold the bow onto the string. Yeah. I mean, it's like your bow is flying off your string. I mean, come on,
Right.
There were challenges. Yeah.
I can make my own mistakes.
Yeah.
How many years have you been there now in Italy?
Just almost 4 years now. Come next month, 4 years will be.
Okay. And I have to ask, any regrets?
No way. No,
not at all. Honestly, not one.
Well, I have one regret, not about the move, but I do regret that my language skills haven't improved to the degree that I want them to be yet. And we are working so much, which I am grateful for, especially after such a long time of not, like, both of our jobs were illegal, you know? We couldn't play concerts, we couldn't organize concerts, and all, you know, international air traffic. So come on, that was rough. So it's nice that we're working so much now, but because we work so much with, in our travel capacity, we work so much with English-speaking clients. We speak a lot of English, and of course, we speak a lot of English to each other. And our Italian has improved a lot, but I'm hoping that after 4 years, I would be better. Oh, deal.
No, I'm sure it's going to come. It'll come. It has.
I think so.
You're living there, so. Yeah.
Well, and it has gotten much better than it was when we got here. And we were already doing pretty well functionally before we moved here. So there are a lot of things we wish we were doing mm-hmm. better. But for instance, we did take and pass the driver's exam to get our driver's license here, the Italian driver's license.
In Italian.
It's the only way to do it is in Italian. Yeah.
Well, they let you take it in German or French, but only in a couple of the regions that are in the very northwest.
No English.
That are close to those countries.
No English. Yeah. No.
Right. I know, way up north, there's a major German influence.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And to the far northwest.
But where we are, and for the most of the country, it's Italian or nothing.
Yeah.
And you have, now we did it. They had 7,000 questions. And from those, they gave you 40. Random 40. So Matt and I took the test on the same day in a classroom on the same day, but he got 40 different questions than me because they're randomized. And to his credit, he got 0 wrong. I got 2 wrong. But you're allowed at that time, you were allowed to get 4 incorrect and still pass. Now they've changed, and you have 30 minutes. It's also timed. Now they've changed it, and it is still the same 7,000 questions, but I think that you have, there are fewer questions.
I think there are 30 questions now instead
30
of 40.
Questions, and I think you can get 3.
Yeah.
So not a huge change. Basically
10%
same.
Margin, you know, a 90% sounds like an A-, but here it's an F.
Well, they write the test in such a way as to confuse native Italian speakers. So it takes a lot of memorization. I have to say, this is where being musicians really helped us.
I got to tell you, that's a hell of an accomplishment to pass it. I'm no scholar in Italian at all, but I mean, I get by pretty good. I can't even imagine taking a driving test in Italian.
It's just rote memorization.
Well, and we did, because we're pretty good at memorization as musicians, so we've developed that skill over decades, you know.
Yeah.
That did serve us pretty well, because we could then look at a question and say, oh, I recognize this question, and this is the trick in it and all that, you know. But it did take us doing about a million practice tests.
Actually, can I just say on a side note that my laziness really helped me with this, because when I was a kid And I would go to every Saturday, I went to orchestra. It was an orchestra that my parents paid for, and they didn't have a lot of money, so it was not a small deal. And almost every week, I would forget my music. And the conductor said, listen, if you forget your music another time, you're going to get kicked out. So, of course, I forgot it, you know. But then, and I forgot it several more weeks in a row. But so I was going to get kicked out, and that was going to be a world of hurt for me. So, what I would do is I would just put my pencil on the stand. I didn't have any music. I just had to play from memory everything. So, and then I would say, I'm not doing this to myself again. I am remembering it next Saturday. And then, of course, I would forget it. I have to do it again.
So she'd have to play again the music from memory. So you got good at memorization instead of remembering to bring your music.
Right.
Yeah, it would have been really smarter if I just remembered to bring music. That's true. But that laziness, I believe, carried over the decades to help me pass this test.
Definitely could be.
So thanks, lazy kid.
It was a challenge. It was also fun being in a classroom, us more or less 50-ish old, 50-year-old people, with a class full of a dozen 14-year-olds that don't even shave yet.
That's always interesting as well.
Yeah, it was absolutely fun. Doused in Axe body spray.
Listen.
I like that. The sounds of hero.
Hear the sound, Frank?
Now it stopped. I heard it though.
Can you hear the siren?
Siren. Yes.
This is the siren of our town. This is, as far as we know, unique to this little town. It was originally an air raid siren in wartime, and then in the 50s, it was used as a, which were sort of fascist years in Italy. It was used as a marking of time for the workers. It would be an 8 o'clock siren in the morning, and then a noon siren marking the lunchtime break time, and then a 5 o'clock siren for quitting time. And that is every single day. Those three sirens go off during the
day. To this day, they still go off all those times.
Yeah. They've retained this, and it's kind of a really neat. It's a little bit disturbing if you hear it at first and you don't know what it is.
Well, the first time it scares the crap out of you.
Because if you're in the square, especially, it's very,
exactly
very loud.
The same sound as the tornado siren that we had in Nashville, Tennessee. So the first time we heard it, we were concerned, and you know when the Ukraine war started. There were a lot of Ukrainian refugees that came here. And so there was a big kerfuffle in town about it because a lot of the refugees got very upset about the siren. And so they shut it off for several weeks.
Really?
And then there was a big
discussion. There were Ukrainian families here who had escaped the war. And it
was upsetting to them. And then after several weeks of it being shut off, it was the discussion came about of, hey, it's time to bring it back. And then there was a lot of discussion that we heard personally and then saw online also. And then they brought it back and I'm glad it's back. I like it, but we're completely inured to it because
you really don't
notice it anymore.
Yeah, that's what happens. So tell us, okay, anybody wants to read the book about moving to Italy, your guidebooks, how do they find all this?
You can find all of that stuff and various pages of our website, which is littleroadseurope.com. And that pretty much says it all. That's our portal for our books, our travel service. And then you can also find us on Facebook very regularly. Zen tells some fantastic stories there, and I chime in once in a while.
We also do have a little website for our working here as musicians in Italy, which is called orsinivirtuosi.it, which is just the two of us. If you want to hear some clips of us playing, you can go there.
Oh, Orsini Virtuosi?
Yeah.
Orsini, which we picked the name because the castle of our town is one of the castles of the family Orsini from centuries ago. There are a bunch of Orsini castles throughout Italy. This is one of them.
Oh, okay. All right.
Orsini were a family that were contemporaries of the Medici.
Of the Medici.
And the Borgias.
I had heard of it.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, guys,
but maybe they didn't poison as many people as the Borgias, so they're not as famous.
I think they poisoned fewer people.
Yeah.
That's always nice. like I said in the beginning, thank you for your time. You're very, very busy people, but you're an inspiration to us all. You pursued and fulfilled the dream. the dream. So my hat is off to you. That's an incredible story, and keep living every day La Dolce Vita.
Thanks so much, Frank. We really appreciate you.
Thanks for taking the time with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you as well.